we're going to get started. The Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight, we don't yet have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order when we do have a quorum. First on the agenda, I guess Representative Lesh, can you go first? Representative Rosenthal, Representative Lesh just got here, so.
Can I have 1 second, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Go for it.
Representative Lesh, I'll have you move your bill after we have a quorum, so go ahead.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for hearing the bill. I'm here to present House File 589, which creates an innovative pilot program for Duluth, St. Paul, Inver Grove Heights, West St. Paul, and South St. Paul in managing cases involving invalid licenses. We did our best to try to get North St. Paul so we could get St. Paul and all the directional St. Pauls, but it didn't work out. Members, I can tell you that as a prosecutor for the city, one of the major headaches for me and for many other prosecutors that have the high volume cases are these invalid license cases that take up a lot of staff time from people, and especially in this era of in the time that we're trying to find ways to manage these cases, this is an important development in how this this is developed, and you'll hear from these folks in a moment. So why don't I just turn it over to my testifiers. I have my boss, City Attorney John Choi, Duluth Assistant City Attorney Carrie Schmies, and City Attorney Corey Land with Inver Grove Heights, West St. Paul, and South St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
John Choi, St. Paul City Attorney for the record. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill that is before you represents a significant amount of work on the part of the St. Paul City Attorney's Office and the cities that are represented here today. I want to thank Representative Lesh for bringing this issue forward. In St. Paul, the City Attorney's Office prosecutors are presented with about 15,000 cases annually per year that we are in charge of prosecuting. About a third of those cases, deal with individuals who are driving without an invalid license, people who have had their driver's licenses suspended, revoked, or canceled. Many of these individuals are repeat offenders. They are coming in the system over and over again. According to the Star Tribune, and there's an article in your packet, this group is twice as likely to get into an accident. The repeat offenders who make up the bulk of these cases either fall into one of two categories. The first category are individuals who just really have no regard for the law. They just do this over and over and over again. The current record in the state of Minnesota is a gentleman by the name of James Crumble. He's been arrested 68 times. Thankfully, the city attorney's office in St. Paul has prosecuted him 5 times, and he's served 81 days in jail. There are 14,000 individuals in Minnesota who have been arrested over 5 times in a 10-year period between January of 2007 to January of 97 to January of 97 to 2007. There's also a graph. There's a Star Tribune article, and I think on the last page of that graph is very illustrative of the problem that we're having. So ultimately, consequences are needed for these individuals to avoid and hold these people accountable. But there's a second group, and there are individuals who mutually want to get valid, but for various reasons, such as limited financial ability, in a lot of instances, if you've got 2 or 3 or 4 arrests, your fines and fees kind of start adding up. And they don't have the financial wherewithal to address the situation and to get valid. And to get valid is also a very difficult process. And also, too, I think there's some issues with respect to just general life skills that I think some of these individuals don't have. So this bill that is before you is to try to address and do something with respect to that latter group and to end this kind of crazy cycle of recidivism. You know, on most days, the criminal justice system is like this assembly line, and it's really about volume, and we do the best that we can to try to manage that volume. But the bill that is here today is an effort to really stop that assembly line and do something great. And it's more about just managing volume. It's about trying to get outcomes in the criminal justice system that will work. And ultimately, the outcome that we're intending and hoping for is that individuals don't cycle through the criminal justice system over and over again. In thinking through creating this diversion program, we came to the conclusion that in order to have a meaningful product that would work for the justice system, we needed your help, and we needed the involvement of the Department of Public Safety. Because the most important part of this bill is the carrot, which is basically the individual who would be diverted into this program would get a valid license. This type of approach has never happened before in the state of Minnesota. We typically tell the individual, you need to get yourself valid, you need to pay the fines, and good luck. And what this is doing is, if there's an appropriate candidate for diversion, we are saying that you can have a valid license, you no longer have to drive without a license. However, you have to meet the terms and conditions of the program. You have to maintain your insurance, you have to make regular payments so that you make good on the outstanding fees and fines, and then you also have to show up for class. And the class will teach them a number of things. I think that's one of the important parts, is the financial management skills, the life skills, and the skills and the information needed to navigate through making yourself good with respect to the court system and at DPS. This also, and I think another highlight of this bill, is that there is no expense to the taxpayer. This is being funded entirely by the offender. This is a great public-private partnership where basically we have so much volume, this is an opportunity where we can partner with the private sector and create this program where essentially we would contract with a vendor, and they would do most of the work in terms of making sure that the actual requirements of the program are being followed. And so I will conclude there, and I'll hand it over to my colleague, Corey Land.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Corey Land, and fortunately for you, I represent three of the cities on this bill. I represent the cities of South St. Paul, West St. Paul, and my firm also represents the city of Invergrove Heights. The court system today is simply overburdened, and I think everybody understands that. And the prosecutors are trying to come up with ways to ease that burden and come up with innovative ideas. This is one of those innovative ideas. Currently today, when someone receives a driving after suspension citation and they decide to appear in court, the prosecutor attempts to work with that person to get them valid. And as Mr. Choi indicated, we don't know exactly what they need to do to get valid, and we kind of put the ball in their court to figure that out. And many of them simply can't. But what we do is we set it for another court appearance. So now you've just taken up at least two court appearances of time with court staff, prosecutor time, perhaps a public defender, because many of these people qualify for a public defender, as well as judge time. And typically they come back to court on the next pretrial calendar, and they still aren't valid, but they're close, and so you give them another chance. And so it just perpetuates the problem, and it adds to the multitude of people that we have on these calendars. So this program, we think, is a great way to solve some of the problem of the overburdened court system. So to summarize the advantages of the program, it's pre-court diversion. So it eliminates the need for in-court prosecutor time, public defender time, court staff time, as well as judge time. It's a long-term solution to get people out of the revolving door of having a driving after suspension citation. Because if they simply pay the citation, they get suspended again. And they continue to drive because they continue to need to get to work or get to pick up the kids or get groceries, and so they'll get another driving after suspension citation. So they have a hard time getting out of that revolving door. This program will teach them to get out, how to get out of the system and stay out of it. And most importantly, as Mr. Choi pointed out, it's self-supporting because the offender pays for the cost of the program. The uniqueness of this particular pilot program is the variety of cities that are included in it. We have cities of the first, second, and third class. We have cities with different demographics and geographic locations throughout the state, urban cities as well as first and second ring suburbs. So we think that it's a nice blend of cities to see if the program will work. We've also limited the qualifying offenses to driving after suspension type offenses so as not to try to tackle too much too soon. And we're optimistic that this pilot program will give us enough information and enough data such that it can be tweaked and molded to see if it can be successful statewide. If it can be successful statewide, that would be a major win for the justice system because it will not only ease the pressure now on the court system by not sending its offenders into court, but it would ease the pressure for years to come because it would teach them to stay out of court. And in addition, we're optimistic that this program might be able to be used as a model for other types of offenses in the future. So we're very excited about this possibility. We want to thank the Department of Public Safety for working with us so closely on trying to develop this program, and we think that it will work.
Questions from members? Representative Mason.
Sorry, Madam Chair. And whoever would like to answer. I mean, this to me is a marvelous idea because I've just seen so many people, as you said, that they can't afford to get out of trouble. But there still are costs that are going to be accruing to them. So what is the most, say, that an individual would have to pay for the program?
Mr. Choi?
Madam Chair and Representative Mason, what we're looking at essentially would be kind of like a fee, and we contemplate that extra fee would be about $100 to pay for the classroom component. But here's the beauty of this, is that we will be able to take payments, and so that would be graduated over, for some individuals, it's going to be a long period of time. It could be 2 years, because if you owe thousands of dollars, and, you know, based upon the assessment of what you can afford to pay, and if that's, you know, maybe, you know, $200 a month or whatever it might be, it's going to take a while to get valid. So I think, you know, obviously, you know, the vendor would need to get paid, but then you have to make good on all of the outstanding fines and fees that are outstanding. So for some individuals, you know, they're going to be able to get good within a very short period of time. But for some individuals, it is going to take quite some time, and we'll have to be patient with that. But the key is they don't have to make that choice of, I got to, you know, drive to work, or I got to do this, but I got this invalid license. Here what we're saying is, immediately upon enrollment in the program, as long as you make your payments, as long as you maintain your insurance, and you come to the classroom and you learn about the things that are important, the financial management, the life skills, and the navigating how you make good on these payments, then, you know, you can still have that diversion license, which is essentially what this legislation is authorizing.
Thank you. Representative Horn.
Madam Chair, members, usually I'm for locking everybody up and throwing away the key, especially if it's a bonehead out there trying to prove his or her authority in driving on a suspended license just because they can or they're too stubborn to listen. But in this case, a number of officers have relayed to me, both from the patrol and my own agency, that it's, like you said, a revolving wheel, and there's just no way to get out of it. They get 3 and 4 tickets backed up against each other, and they get picked up, and the trooper or somebody says to him, why are you out here driving? Don't you know any better? And he says, or he or she says, I got to get to work. You know, they can't pay the fines, can't get to work, can't pay their child support, another reason they get their license revoked. There's so many reasons they get revoked, suspension, fines not paid, or insurance, or this or that, but they still have to get to work, and some of them don't have time or can't get off to get to court. So I don't know the general bill, of, at least I support the concept that they're trying to do, is trying to help these drivers out, because some of them, you know, just a victim of the process, and they would like to change it and get their driver's license in order. So anything I can do to help, so I support the general concept, what he's trying to do.
Okay. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either one of the testifiers. It was referenced that the court systems are backed up with a lot of these cases. By having this diversion project, do you have a number, a percentage of how many court cases may not end up in the system anymore if we get this diversion project authorized?
Ms. Land? Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, it's anticipated that we'll give just about everybody a first bite at the apple, and we anticipate that there are about one-third of our cases on our respective calendars that are driving after citations. So the plan is that we'll give everybody an opportunity, regardless of whether it's their first offense or their 20th offense, to try the program. And if they fail, then we'll put them back into the court system.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions from members, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Less renews his motion that House File 589 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Next on the agenda. Next on the agenda is Representative Smith. Representative Smith, it's my understanding that this bill would stay here and be laid over for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I would appreciate that if we could do that, yes.
All right. Then the Chair moves that House File 1039 be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you. And members, I want to explain what the bill does, and then I have Commissioner Dingell here, Commissioner for Facilities, Department of Corrections, to give you a little testimony. Madam Chair, the bill before you adds three words to an existing statute, specifically 609.2232, which is a law that was enacted in 1997. For 12 years, the law has represented the intent of the legislature, which was that when inmates commit assault in prison, and that if they are charged and the matter is prosecuted to its conclusion, that the term when executed would run consecutively with whatever sentence that they are currently serving. So we're adding by this bill the words shall run consecutively and not concurrently. Madam Chair and members, I asked for some data from the Commissioner of Corrections, and it would appear that in FY08 alone, there were 652 assaults of inmates, 551 on inmates, 65 with causing harm, 27 with weapons, and 9 with weapons causing harm. There was 142 assaults on our correction staff, 107 assaults, 10 causing harm, 23 with weapons, and 2 with weapons causing harm. Of those numbers, 31 assaults on staff were referred for prosecution, and 31 additional assaults on inmates were referred for prosecution. I'm going to let the commissioner tell you that our law is not being followed in all cases, and the beauty of our system under checks and balances, when we do something wrong, the courts can tell us, and when they do something we don't like, we can then proceed to tell them back. And I think we should put these three words into our law so it is abundantly clear that any sentencing of inmates for assault done while incarceration be received with sentences that do in fact run consecutively. And I would now ask the commissioner to address the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lynn Dingell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner over the Adult Facilities and Juvenile Facilities in our department. I want to thank Representative Smith and also mention Representative Hawes. They've both been very concerned about this language and the lack of following that language on several occasions. I've worked in prisons for 34 years. I was the warden of four of them, and I can tell you that staff are absolutely devastated when they've been assaulted by an inmate. They go to, they get prosecuted, they get found guilty, and then a judge fails to follow the language and gives them a concurrent sentence or, quote, time served, so to speak. The inmate then comes back to the facility and starts bragging about how you can take a shot at any staff member because nothing's going to happen to you. And that is devastating for our staff. While I was the warden for 4 years at Oak Park Heights, and then the next 3 years I was the warden at Stillwater, I can think of three cases anecdotally that came back from court where the inmate was failed to be sentenced consecutively, but concurrently. And in one case, they actually gave them jail credit for the prison time they were already serving, which again is in the statute. So we really appreciate Representative Smith and Representative Hawes and your support also. Safety of our staff is foremost for us.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I absolutely support what you're doing. I guess I, as a huge advocate and supporter of our courts, I find it somewhat odd that you would have to come forward with this legislation, but as you've explained, we have the opportunity to help our friends in the third branch understand that, you know, this unfortunately can't do underscore in the statute books, but this is about, I think, as close as we can get to underscoring what the legislative intent is. So it's unfortunate that you have to even come forward with the bill, but I appreciate you doing so.
Thank you.
For members, Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, thank you. Maybe to the warden, was there some reason given an opinion? I mean, it already says this, so we're not changing anything really in the law. We're adding a couple words that just are already there. Was there some, did they make some reason in the opinion that, or in the sentencing, and aren't they going to be able to do that still?
Ms. Dingell.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, there was no comments made or any reason given. They don't get the sentencing transcripts anymore from the courts. We do have cooperation, though, from the county attorney, who we will then call up and ask him to remind the judges of that statute specifically. So I really can't answer your question as to why that occurred.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 39 for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you for your courtesy.
Next on the agenda is Representative Bingham. Representative Bingham moves that House File 1144 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy bill. Representative Bingham, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the spirit of making some cuts to our budget to get it balanced by the time we need to, I introduced a bill along with some of the other members of the committee here I have an amendment. I'm sorry. I should move my amendment first before I get ahead of myself and explain my bill.
Okay. Representative Bingham moved the A1 amendment.
Yes.
Representative Bingham.
The A1 amendment kind of more clearly points out what I would like to do with the bill overall.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now to the bill as amended. We all know that there's a lot of reports that the Sentencing Guideline Commission does, and Section 1 of the bill will ask that they consolidate the legislatively mandated reports to reduce some of the burdens that they have. And however, we would not like them to eliminate some of them because they are used for a purpose without us having that approval. For example, and I do have here the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, Susan Allegro, that we'll be able to talk a little bit more about this. But, you know, we have numerous reports that deal with motor vehicles, whether it's criminal vehicular crimes, whether it's DWI crimes, and I just don't understand why we have to have all these separate reports, and why can't we just have one, and then the people can, who are requesting information, can go to the website, download the whole report, and then take what they want from it versus having them do a bunch of these. So that's one example. We also have one dealing with criminal sexual conduct, too. Section 2 is a repealer, and we are repealing the special report to the legislature on the juvenile out-of-state placement and alternative placement. The Department of Corrections already does this report, and so we are asking the Sentencing Guideline Commission to stop doing that. So with that, I would ask that Ms. Allegro be able to address the committee.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro, Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I'd like to thank Representative Bingham for working with me on this issue. Basically, as Representative Bingham points out, we have in the past produced a number of reports. Some of them, at the time we were asked to start producing them, you know, the issue might have been more in the forefront of people's minds, and then I think, you know, sometimes the focus shifts. We have since 2000 been required to report any out-of-state placement of juveniles and also any alternative placements, whether in-state or out-state, for any juvenile that would qualify to go to the correctional facility at Red Wing. In 2003, as Representative Bingham mentioned, the Department of Corrections was also directed to maintain similar information. When I appeared in front of the House Public Safety Committee, Finance Committee, we were asked, are there any efficiencies that we thought could, you know, help us reduce costs? And this is one that obviously there's duplication with the Department of Corrections. We really don't get the reports coming from the courts. Corrections reported, for example, 190 out-of-state placements, while we only got 18. So we really feel, given the low numbers, given the fact that this report is duplicative of Department of Corrections, we really shouldn't, we ask you that we not be required to produce it. As Representative Bingham pointed out, there are also a number of other reports, some that are used quite extensively that we would keep, but we also feel this would be an opportunity to talk with our constituents and see, you know, are there any reports that could either be eliminated or consolidated, and we certainly, as the legislation points out, would not eliminate anything that is legislatively mandated.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, as a co-author on the bill, I certainly like the spirit of where you're headed. I guess the challenge that I have, or the question I have, is I'm not sure that I really understand the full extent of the reporting done by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And I guess my request, Ms. Allegro, if it's not something that is hugely challenging to do, and I wouldn't imagine it would be, could you provide this committee with a list of all of the legislatively mandated reporting requirements? What is the reporting requirement? How often do you have to do it? That's the first thing. And secondly, are there other reports that you're generating for other your other constituencies, the courts, corrections, whomever, that aren't legislatively mandated? I may want to work with Representative Bingham and you to be a little more definitive in terms of what we're doing. And well, courts may want you to continue to do a report. If we're not going to fund it, we may want to take a look at that as the policymakers.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Coles, I'm already a quick step ahead of you. There are only a couple legislatively mandated, I'm sorry, Mr. Bearden, you're right in my mind of, oh, there you go, and now Representative Letches. But anyway, the legislature only has a couple legislatively mandated reports the Sentencing Guideline Commission has, but there are a few other agency-directed ones, and I'm assuming what Ms. Legler will tell you is that they actually can do that. They can already eliminate some of these without legislation, and I've talked to her about that. But
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, as Representative Bingham mentioned, we have three legislatively mandated reports. One is the juvenile placement. Another is our annual report, and then the third is a firearms report, which we include as part of our annual report. Those are our mandated reporting requirements. And then we also have a number of agency-directed reports that we can, we started, and we on our own could eliminate or consolidate those.
Representative Cole.
Ms. Allegro, do you charge agencies for the time used by your staff in compiling a report that either you initiated or has been requested by another agency?
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, we do not. Most of all of our reports are located on our website, and typically what would happen is most of the when somebody asks for information or asks for a report, we direct them to the website so that they would go ahead and download it. Now, I do understand there is a bill in the Senate that any annual reports would be able to do most of those electronically, and we certainly would support something like that as well, because I think with our legislatively mandated reports, while a lot of the time is staff time, it is very heavily the copying cost. So that's the other thing.
Representative Paul.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Allegro, maybe my question wasn't clear. I understand you have your annual report and firearms report and this child placement report, but I thought I understood you to say that there are reports that are created at the request of other agencies or that you had initiated at some point in time. And so my question is for those, I understand you're putting them on the internet, and that's great, but somebody's using, you know, we're using human resources, we have to deal with the cost associated with those human resources. And so when your staff does research and prepares a report for somebody else, is there a charge to whomever has made that request? Or am I not understanding the way that the reporting works?
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, basically we do not charge for any of our reports. That either they would, they typically would get it off the internet, but we do not charge anybody that makes the request.
Ms. Allega, to put it another way, Representative Cole, if I might, are you putting together reports at the request of other agencies?
Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Cole. No, we when I say our constituencies, typically what might happen is in a given year we might have gotten requests, for example, for information on crim sex conduct that a number of different agencies might have asked for, so therefore we started to produce a report on that particular topic. It would be in our judgment whether or not to go ahead based on the number of data requests we get, whether to produce a separate report.
And then, Representative Cole, then do you charge someone who has requested that type of report for the putting together of the report?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Is that your answer, Representative Cole?
I think I've got it now.
Okay.
Thank you for your
Other questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 1144 as amended. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam.
Next on the agenda is Representative Rosenthal. All right, Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 1274 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's a pretty straightforward bill, which comes from the governor's executive order of January of last year, and simply seeks to codify that executive order into law and creating a state interoperability panel. And for that, I have Mr. Wiggins to speak to the specifics of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Scott Wiggins. I'm the Director of the Division of Emergency Communication Networks at the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Appreciate Representative Rosenthal carrying this bill for us. As he's indicated, that this bill is a result of an executive order that the governor put together for us. It's been in place since late 2007. As a result of the executive order, we've established the Statewide Radio Board, which is under Minnesota law as the Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee. And really what this legislation does is just take the elements of the governor's executive order, which we've been operating under since January of 2008, and puts them into law.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 1274 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Representative Hilstrom, would you like to move your bill?
I do, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure if this trespass bill needs to go somewhere else. Doesn't.
Nope, I think we'll be laying it over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill.
All right, I would move that House File 1264 be recommended to pass and be laid over for the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Madam Chair and members, this was brought to me by Minneapolis, and so I would like them to talk to the bill.
Madam Have everybody just state their name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dana Banwer. I'm with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and with me also is Inspector Chris Arneson with Minneapolis's 5th Precinct. We brought this matter forward, unfortunately, as a result of the 35W bridge collapse and the issues that arose around that, and I'll leave it to Inspector Arneson to describe those in a little more detail. But what happened there is obviously a major disaster where emergency vehicles and personnel were sent. It was a recovery effort, and as can be expected, a lot of people, citizens, rushed to the scene both to try to help out, but also just to try to get a look at what was happening. In fact, in some of the police reports that I personally reviewed, a lot of citizens said they just wanted to get a look at what was happening, wanted to get a closer view of the bridge collapse scene. When it came time for the police to actually charge these people with offenses who had not obeyed the police order by leaving the scene after the police asked them to leave, it appeared to us, or it became clear to us, that there were not appropriate charges in some cases. And even though you might think that the trespassing statute would apply to cases of that nature, in fact, there was no appropriate provision within the trespass statute that applied. And many of these people were actually charged, but we had to get a little bit creative along with the police department, and we ended up charging individuals with things like obstructing legal process as a misdemeanor, and also we saw many charges that resulted from failure to obey a lawful order of a police officer. You would think that that would apply to that situation, but if you look closely to that offense, it's actually in the traffic code in 169.02, and it only applies to individuals who are in vehicles. Bicycles are included under that definition, and so because many of these individuals approach the crime scene actually riding bicycles, we ended up with quite a few charges under that statute as well. So the language that we have proposed covers the situation where police have cordoned off either a crime scene or a natural disaster scene, a scene of this nature, and it would apply to those situations where people are coming to get a closer look, police ask them to leave, and they don't leave. I might just point out very quickly, the trespass statute, as you probably know, is derived from the old agrarian society and was meant to address things such as individuals, animals, trespassing onto the land of another, or individuals trespassing onto someone else's land to take their crops or their fruit or their vegetables, and doesn't really apply to the post 9/11 situation where we have had terrorist events or other natural disasters. And so, you know, we feel that this amendment is needed to address those situations.
Yeah. Madam Speaker, I promoted you, Madam Chair. Did you have other testifiers, or did you want to?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon. Chris Arneson with the Minneapolis Police Department. After the bridge collapsed, I was in charge of staffing all the posts around the fallen bridge to keep that area safe while we recovered people from that area and evidence. We used hundreds of officers to do that over a 10-day period. But even what we had in officer strength, we weren't able to keep that area as safe as we wanted, so we had to string up crime scene tape or barricades to do that. Even during that, people did get across those barriers at some danger to themselves at sometimes, might I add. What they were looking for is they wanted souvenirs from the bridge or the victims of the bridge. They were investigators for attorneys. One person was actually selling consulting services. He was a rigger. I'm not sure what a rigger is, but something to do with riggers. There was a man trying to sell sonar services for recovery underwater, and to take pictures of the scene also. We actually treated this area initially as a crime scene because we didn't know what we had, and when they crossed into that, that's what we arrested them for. But as Dana Banner pointed out, we had trouble with that, that's why this is important to us.
Madam Chair, I actually do have a technical amendment. On line 3.5, there is a reference to 626.84 subdivision 2, and the reference should be to subdivision 1.
Okay. You move that amendment, Commissioner Hilstrom?
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment, or do members need that repeated?
I need it repeated, Madam Chair. What does that do?
On line 3.5, there is a reference to 626.84 subdivision 2.
Yes.
And the reference should be to subdivision 1, the definition of a peace officer.
Is that, Madam Chair, if I may?
Representative Black.
Is that because it's just a typo in the sense that subdivision 2 has no reference to the definition of a peace officer?
That's correct,
okay.
Representative Black.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the amendment, Representative Raskowski?
Oh, it's on the amendment.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment carries. Representative Hilstrom, is there anything else to your bill as amended?
That's it, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Raskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this question would be for either the police officer or the other city attorney. I'm sorry. Other means conspicuously placed and identifying the area. What would other means be? It seems like kind of a catch-all broad term there. I guess it seems kind of loose.
Madam Chair and Representative, it would depend on the situation, and Inspector Arneson may be able to address that as well, but it would depend on the situation. In a limited crime scene, it would most likely be police tape if the area is small enough to cordon off. If it's a larger area like the bridge, they use sawhorses and cones and things of that nature, but I don't know if Inspector Arneson has anything to add.
Inspector Arneson?
Thank you, madam. It also could include squad cars if the area is large enough. Sometimes we do string crime scene tape between squad cars because there's not a tree or a building to attach it to.
Any further questions, Representative Raskowski?
No, thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Banner, can you give an example of the reasons that jurors have given for refusing to render jury verdicts on these cases where they were charged with OLP, obstruction of legal process, for example, and why was that a problematic statute to proceed on here?
Ms. Benway, and I will ask Representative West to use the microphone when he's addressing the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative West. Obstructing legal process was used somewhat, and I don't believe we had any of these cases go to trial under that statute. We did have one go to trial conclude somewhat recently under the traffic statute that I mentioned. But one of the problems with obstructing legal process is, you know, we can only use it in limited circumstances, and we have to prove that the person actively interfered with the police. So for the police to say, you can't be here, you need to leave, and the person refuses to leave, it may not be enough for a jury to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. They may not believe that that person actively interfered with the police officer when the police officer instructed the person to leave.
Follow-up, Representative West?
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, I don't have a follow-up question. I guess that would be my question. The reason for creating a new statute, I would think, would be that the old one failed and that we couldn't get to convictions. I imagine, yes, that a jury would have to consider whether or not a police officer had just cause to consider that an individual was interfering. Then under this statute, you could just put up a rope and then there'd be no question about it. And there's no limit on how big a police officer would want to make that cordoned off area, as far as I could tell, which is why the obstructing legal process statute is written the way
It is, and I proceeded to trial and obstructing legal process multiple times. So I guess that's my question is, why the need? And I'm assuming the need was that you proceeded to trial and jurors said, yep, we can't get the conviction on this. But it was clear that this person was clearly interfering. And I don't hear any examples of that.
Ms. Benmer?
Madam Chair and Representative Bless, I don't really have the answer that you're looking for because, as I said, I don't, to my knowledge, we did not go to trial on any obstructing legal process charges arising from this incident. We have on plenty of other obstructing legal process charges in other situations. It's not one that that jurors readily accept, I would say, at least not in Hennepin County. The need in our minds and in the minds of the police department stemmed from the fact that it seemed the most appropriate charge was something that directly addressed this situation. And the bridge collapse isn't an isolated incident. There have been other incidents where, we've been faced with this situation and it didn't seem as though, or there didn't appear to be an appropriate charge or a on-point charge, if you will. Thus, putting this language together.
Okay, I do have a follow-up. In light of that, Ms. Banner, for example, in the way the language is crafted, I can envision a scenario where a defense attorney suggests that an individual had to have notice that this was lawfully cordoned off. And if someone just wandered into some area that they assume was a construction site or maybe area that wasn't lawfully cordoned off, that's going to be fodder for multiple pretrial hearings to have this evidence excluded and thereby the case tossed. How would you deal with scenarios like that?
Ben Wynn.
Madam Chair and Representative Bless, I'll just talk briefly, but Inspector Arneson would like to say something as well. But what we would do, I imagine, and not, being faced with that situation right now, is put the police officer or officers on the stand to testify about cordoning off the area and, thereby addressing that element of the offense.
Okay, well, and I'm sorry, this will be my last question because I know I'm taking up the committee time, but is there going to be a policy in place then, I suppose this question is for Inspector Arneson, that the cordoning off has to say police line, or does the entire area have that yellow tape that says police line do not cross, or the testimony was it could be any other kind of barrier where a person could reasonably suggest that, well, I didn't know that was a police line. Do you follow me?
Inspector Arneson?
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, that's exactly right. We would have a tape up that says police line don't cross, or an indication on that barrier that this is a police line and they cannot cross.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Anderson?
I'm sure that the question that I had has been answered.
Okay. Representative Rashkowski.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Two questions, Ms. Bandler and Inspector Arneson. I did pull out your names on the sheet, so I've got them now. Thanks. The implications that this might have for private property, if you've got a homeowner and their home is included in that area that's cordoned off, how would it affect that? And the second question is related to kind of Representative Lesh's area of questioning. I mean, if you got these sawhorses or other barriers that are laid out there and you've got a group of people around them, I guess you could envision a situation where someone may move one and reposition things and there may be some uncertainty that may arise out of that. I guess your comments on that. Those are the two parts of my question.
Inspector Arneson,
thank you. I would suggest that common sense rules. Typically in a trespass case, we'll give people a notice that they are trespassing and they have to leave the area. And then if they don't leave, we can put them under arrest. Okay. Secondly, if it's the homeowner, if it's a homicide scene, and I worked as a homicide investigator for years, we're usually, if we cordon off the house, and we're working with the homeowner. But I think, again, it's just common sense. You know, you work with the person that whose house it is. If they have to go in, we'll give them an escort in until the crime scene is released.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question, probably for Ms. Banwar. Is there a definition? I'm a little confused about this term lawfully cordoned off. I don't know what that means. Are there any restrictions or standard? You know, Representative Lash talked about, you know, cordoning off a big, huge area. I understand kind of what we're getting at here. I'm not necessarily opposed, but to some extent, it sounds like we've got a bit of a scenario of a solution in search of a problem, and maybe we're taking too big of a whack. Can you talk to that lawfully cordoned off and what that means? I understand the common sense thing, and the law enforcement officers I know tend to operate with a whole lot of common sense, but we see examples around here all the time of where common sense doesn't always prevail. I'd be curious if you could comment on that.
Ms. Stanley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Cole. We have not defined that in this legislation, and I would echo what Inspector Arneson said, that common sense rule. However, in my mind, what that means is a lawfully cordoned off means a police officer acting under the color of law has cordoned it off. And that would be indicated to the individual who approaches that scene by the presence of some kind of notice, either, you know, a placard, if there's time for that, or police tape, or police officers stationed at the scene, indicating that we have cordoned off this area, we have designated this area as a crime scene or a disaster scene or whatever, and you, the public, may not enter.
One final question, Madam Chair. Representative Kilstrom, maybe we can talk about this afterwards. As I read Small Roman 2, we talk about peace officers, and you got to get permission from a peace officer as an affirmative defense. I'm envisioning a scenario where there is a natural disaster and potentially somebody else with authority other than a peace officer gives somebody permission to enter an area that has been cordoned off. For example, a city engineer who's escorting somebody into the home and the sheriff's deputy or the police officer is not there. We may need to work on that to make sure that we're if this is going to move forward, that we're not being too narrow in who we're giving that affirmative defense to.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thank you. Representative Coles, I'm happy to work with you on this. I agreed to carry this bill because when different people act the exact same way at a scene, they should get charged with the same crime. You shouldn't have to creatively look through the statute to figure out what can I charge this person with and what crime can I charge the other person with. So I'm happy to work with language to make certain that we give the folks that need the tool the ability to prosecute those that they need to. Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay, is there anyone in the audience that would... Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilton, I don't want to make any corrections now, but when they're talking about police and peace officers, if you could think about getting rid of the word police and just keep peace officer, because nowadays in statute they don't use much police, deputy, trooper, they don't specify whether it's police or sheriff. They use the term, universal term, peace officer as defined in 62684. It would be helpful if it just said peace officer to me, but just something to think about and stop the next committee.
It's staying here.
What's that?
This bill's staying here. So we can do whatever we want to.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you.
Representative Lash.
I have a hypothetical for Ms. Arneson, maybe Ms. Banwar. I'm thinking about the RNC, and I'm thinking about these situations where you had protesters that, under the rubric established by law enforcement, certain things would happen up until the point when it was declared an unlawful assembly. At that point, after it was declared an unlawful assembly, and people wouldn't go, technically under law they could be charged. Could you envision a scenario where there was an unlawful assembly and you still put a police lineup around it and then start cherry picking the folks out of there? Could you do that under this language?
Inspector Arneson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No. No, this is meant to protect the scene where there's evidence at the scene or something that we need to collect and we can't catch it right away. So I would answer no, that we would not use this for that.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Arison, but that wasn't my question. If you would or would not use it, I'm saying, could you use it for that? Under the language, could it potentially be used for that?
Dr. Arnonson, I don't read that into the language. I don't. Representative Jaskowski?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Ms. Arnonson, the language about the direction of a peace officer engaged in, who would you relegate these duties to otherwise other than a peace officer? Who else would be putting up the tape or the barricades or the police cars or whatever?
Inspector Arnonson. Madam Chair, thank you. It's possible that we would regulate this to a firefighter or a community service officer who works for us. Okay, any other questions? Anybody in the audience would like to testify in support or against the bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over the bill. Oh, wait, I think you should have renewed your motion first. I'm sorry.
That's fine, Madam Chair, and with the amendment.
And as amended.
Correct.
It's still laid over. Representative Hillstrom, I think you have another bill up, too.
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 702 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I was also brought this bill, and so I will let the testifiers talk about it.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cheryl Krieger. I'm the Associate Director with the Juvenile Justice Coalition in Minnesota, and I would like to provide you just some background information about the bill that we're presenting. The Juvenile Justice Coalition in Minnesota is an organization that brings together folks involved with juvenile justice in Minnesota, key stakeholders, professionals, organizations that are involved with the system in trying to improve our juvenile justice system here in Minnesota. We have brought together stakeholders and individuals to look at identifying priority areas to improve our system. One of the top issues identified by this group of individuals was to address the overrepresentation of youth of color within Minnesota's juvenile justice system. Currently, there is federal legislation that Minnesota is mandated to meet 4 core requirements, and I want to go over those really briefly because it relates to this legislation. The first one is that states may not hold status offenders in detention or secure confinement. The second is juveniles cannot be held in an adult jail or lockup, and there are some exceptions to that. The third is that with those exceptions, if a juvenile is held in an adult jail, they have to be separated from adults. They cannot hear them or see them. The fourth core requirement, which is related to this proposed legislation, is states are required to assess and address disproportionate minority contacts within the juvenile justice system. They are required to collect data at key contact points within the system, starting at arrest, going through diversion, disposition, all the way through the system. It's been part of the federal statute since 1988, and all states face this critical issue within their communities and within their states. And the reason why we are bringing this legislation forward is because several reasons. First, while Minnesota currently collects most of the data required by the federal legislation, we are not collecting all of the data required, nor for all of the key contact points that the legislation mandates Minnesota to collect. Because we don't have currently any state mandate to collect the data that is being collected varies year to year. It's not always uniform. There are issues with how standard the data is being collected. And so this is an issue for our state. If we are found out of compliance with this federal mandate, we could receive a penalty of 20% of the federal dollars that we receive from the Office of Juvenile Justice Programs to address juvenile prevention efforts in our state and implementing best practices. And so part of our recommendation for bringing this legislation forward is to make sure that Minnesota is following the mandates of this federal legislation. The other piece is we do know from the data we're currently collecting that overrepresentation of youth of color is a critical issue facing our state,
This data will allow us to identify the reasons for those disparities and help us come up with the solutions that we need to address those. The third piece is this information will not only impact youth of color in our system, but it will also provide us the data information we need to make the system more efficient and effective for all youth involved in Minnesota's juvenile justice system. We don't have all the data we need, and so when we're trying to make it more efficient, have better outcomes for youth, use our limited resources more wisely, we don't have the information we need to make those wise decisions. And this data collected through the SIL will give us that information. And the fourth reason is this will align Minnesota's data practices not only with the current legislation, but right now there are efforts nationally to strengthen the GMC component of the federal legislation. The Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act is currently up for reauthorization at Congress, and there are efforts to strengthen the DMC component. One of those components is to make sure that states identify data at key contact points, which we've identified in this proposed legislation. The other piece is to make sure that there are data practices and data collected at the local level, which we address with this, and make sure that that information is made public and that the state comes up with a plan to address the overrepresentation of youth of color, and that's what this legislation addresses. And so we are recommending this to make the state in compliance and to address this critical issue facing our state and to help us make our juvenile justice system more efficient and effective for all youth involved in our system. I'm going to turn it over to Professor Levy Pounds to talk about how this impacts our community.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Professor Nakima Levy Pounds, and I'm from the University of St. Thomas School of Law. I assure you I did not wear St. Thomas colors on purpose, but it is a pleasure to be here. I direct a program at St. Thomas called the Community Justice Project, and our primary area of focus is on advocating on behalf of the voice of the community. And so we are focusing on juvenile justice reform. We have worked with folks at the local level in local government as well as within the community. As a law professor, my scholarly agenda focuses on the impact of the war on drugs for communities of color and children. And so with that particular research that I've done, along with some of the anecdotal evidence that we've seen, we need to get a clearer picture of who the children are who are incarcerated in our juvenile justice system in Minnesota. One of the things that the research shows us is that about 87% of children in the juvenile justice system are functionally illiterate. When you look at some of the more recent information that has been put forth by the Children's Defense Fund, we know that in Minnesota there is a correlation between illiteracy, poverty, and the juvenile justice system. For example, in 2005, a disproportionate number of black and Latino fourth graders could not read at grade level. In Minnesota, 90% of black children couldn't read at grade level. 82% of Latino children could not read at grade level, and 57% of white children. Now, one of the ways in which this impacts our justice system is the fact that in Minnesota, we look at third grade reading scores to predict the prison population 10 years out. So we see that there is a connection between illiteracy and one's propensity to enter the juvenile justice system. And so what this particular legislation will do is to hold stakeholders accountable to ensure that our system is run more efficiently and fairly, so that those kids who do end up going into the justice system are there because they belong there, not because of some arbitrary decision-making that could happen during the different entry points into the system. And so each key decision-maker at an entry point would be forced through this legislation to identify particular demographic information related to each youth involved in the system. And what we would be able to do as a state in analyzing the data is to, number one, look at the patterns of decision-making and ensure that similarly situated youth across racial lines are treated fairly and justly, and that there are not the level of disparities that currently exist because of the level of discretion that exists. So it will be beneficial to us in the state of Minnesota just to ensure that all of the children that come into the system are there because they belong. We're also finding that children within our juvenile justice system have high rates of mental health issues. So you have a combination of children of poor children of color. You also have poor children in rural areas who are white that are involved in the system. High rates of mental health issues, low literacy rates, and those are really fueling a pipeline to prison for our young people. And if we do not hold the decision makers accountable, then what we can ensure is that a larger percentage of our workforce for the future will have criminal records, and we research the collateral consequences of having a criminal conviction, even from the time that one is a youth. And what we're finding is bars to access to employment, housing, and just socioeconomic stability. So there's a really strong and compelling reason why we would want to know why our children are being incarcerated. And just as a final note, Minnesota spends 3.7 times as much per prisoner as per public school pupil. So we do have a lot of work to do, but this legislation will open the door to our ability to transform the system and to hold the proper authorities accountable to ensure that every child who is in the justice system is there because they belong there and not for some other arbitrary reason.
Thank you. Representative Hilton, do you have any other testifiers? Okay, members with questions, Representative Pema.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilstrom, is this still going other places?
Yes, Representative Hilstrom. Representative Paymar, it's going to civil law, and then I would assume it's coming to you.
Okay, and are you going, I like the bill, but I just want to know if you're requesting a fiscal note, or do you have some sense of how much it will cost for the commissioner to do this, and then it's a report every year. This is an ongoing expense.
Mr. Chair, I will be requesting a fiscal note on it. Do you have an idea how much it costs?
Members of the committee, Madam Chairwoman, some parts of the bill, what we know is would be minimal cost because it's already occurring. There may be some costs for data collection that is not currently happening at the local level, but we do not have all of that information at this time.
Okay. Representative Paymar.
There's going to be a cost to the department to do this, so we'll need to find that out.
Okay. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just trying to get a handle on exactly what you're trying to do here. As I read this bill, having prosecuted for 32 years and handled juveniles for 32 years, it looks like every time I touched a juvenile petition in my county, I would have had to file paperwork or kept records of 130 or 140 cases every year when I didn't have assistants or extra work staff. Is that correct reading, Ms.?
Representative Hilstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's at the entry point, so not each and every time you touch the file, but each and every time you were there was an entry point into the system. There would be a requirement to collect the data.
Yes, I realize that, but an entry point, I believe, is referred to as petitioning the child for an offense, which would mean every time I get a petition, I'm going to be filing this, having to keep these records.
Representative Hilstrom.
That is correct.
Representative Anderson?
I've got a
follow-up. Representative Olin?
I'm a little concerned, and maybe I'm overreacting because I don't know what the form would look like, but I'm a little concerned that in your rural counties that you don't have the staff being that maybe needed to actually do this paperwork.
Thank you. Representative Olin, I understand that is a concern, and that's one of the reasons why I'm carrying the bill, because we want to make certain that whatever passes is workable and actually gets us to where we need to go.
I am very concerned that the cost factor could enter into a small county attorney trying to handle these.
Okay. Testify?
I was just going to add that our office, along with other key stakeholders, have agreed to develop an instrument that can be used to promote uniformity across these different systems. And we have actually already started to meet to talk about what would this instrument look like and what specific information would be needed in order for us to comply with the federal legislation that already exists. So as Cheryl Kruger said, there is already this requirement, and we do have a need to comply from the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, you mentioned in your testimony something about holding stakeholders accountable and investigating patterns of decision making. Are you including parents in that?
In what regard?
As a stakeholder or patterns of decision making?
That's a good question. One of the things that we do in particular is to mobilize with the community and talk to parents. One of our programs, for example, through St. Thomas, involves our going out to schools at the local elementary, junior high, and high school level and trying to train children specifically about the laws that are likely to impact them. Because what we're seeing is that children are engaged in criminal behavior and aren't aware of it. So, for example, carrying a BB gun on school property could now be charged as a felony. That did not used to be the case. And so, in addition to talking to school children, we're also holding community meetings where parents are brought into the picture, and we do discuss these particular issues with parents. Now, in looking at our juvenile justice system, one of the things that we're finding is that parents aren't as engaged in the process. There are a number of reasons why this is the case. Oftentimes, at least for some of the poor children of color that we're referring to, you have parents who have a lower levels of education. You also have parents who are single parents, usually single mothers, working multiple jobs, and we've even heard anecdotal accounts of parents who lost their jobs because they had to return to court multiple times to be there with their children. The other thing that I think is important to realize is that as a parent, we can do the best that we can to raise our children, but ultimately our children could make decisions that fall outside the scope of how we have raised them. And that runs across racial lines and socioeconomic lines. So I think that that's important to factor in. From the town hall meetings that we've done in the community, one of the things that we have seen is an outcry from parents. Number one, in wanting to know what can we do if our children are acting out in school and the school wants to suspend them or refer a case to the juvenile justice system, what are our options? And wanting more resources within the community. One recent thing that's happening because of the economic crisis is that 8 recreational centers in the city of St. Paul are up for closure. And so that means for those children who are latchkey kids or whose parents don't have resources for them, they're just going to be out in the community with nowhere to go. So you do have parents who are crying out for assistance, but I would say as a parent, I know that I can only do so much by training my children in the way that they should go, and then the children are making decisions.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Professor and Representative Hillstrom, I think for purpose of this bill, you should include parents in the jurisdiction in here as far as being the stakeholders or investigating the patterns of decision making, and make that part of your, because if you don't include the parents, I think you've lost the whole thing.
I
just said thank you, and I will talk to the stakeholders that brought me this bill and see what they think.
All right. Representative Joskowski.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Professor Levy Pons, I was kind of taken back by some of your testimony. The arbitrary decision making, it sounds like there's a premise that that there's arbitrary decision making going on by people who are arresting kids, etc. Wants to know why, hoping that the reports will help us learn why our children are being incarcerated. I mean, aren't our children being incarcerated because they break the law?
I can just give you an example. For example, for Ramsey County, for their Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative and Disproportionate Minority Contact issue, they issued a statement that said that in 2004, Ramsey County admitted 3,124 youth into secure detention. 71% of them were youth of color. Only 22% were for violent crimes, weapons, drugs, or sex. So if you think about the fact that just 22% fall under the category of being incarcerated for violent crimes, weapons, drugs, or sex, then that means that there's quite a bit of discretion for the other 78% who, for example, may have gotten into a school fight. Back when I was in school, getting into a school fight may have meant
that you set out, you know, during recess or were suspended from school or expelled. But now what we're finding is that about 25% of cases that are being referred to the juvenile justice system are coming from schools. And some of them are for situations like school fights where there were no weapons involved, even beginning at the elementary school level. So we've talked to some of the public defenders in the local community. And from their perspective, there is quite a bit of discretion in terms of who gets charged with what particular crimes and whether there are other options available aside from secure detention. One of the other things that the research shows is that secure detention of a minor is one of the greatest and probably the single greatest predictor of adult criminality and entryway into the adult criminal justice system. So there are a lot of repercussions when we decide to securely detain young people in circumstances where they are not engaged in ongoing criminal activity and where there are other options available that will not cause as much trauma as incarceration.
Okay, Representative Hilton, something to add?
Yes, Representative Griskowski, all this is doing is collecting the data, not saying we're doing anything different after. But it's very difficult to know what is the best thing to do after if you don't even know how you're getting to where you are. For example, Hennepin County is actually specifically looking at whether or not they are going to choose to incarcerate some juveniles at certain levels because they're finding their research is showing that the more contact the child is having with the system, the more likely they are to do bad things and end up incarcerated later. And so different communities are looking at different programming. And all we're saying is we just want to know what the data shows, and someone else will have to carry a bill to make those other changes.
Representative Skowski, and we have a couple other questions.
Yeah, thank you both. The other concern I have about this is the fact that here again we have another mandate coming forward. I hear nothing more in my local community other than please don't send us any more mandates and we need to undo the mandates. And folks, this goes the other direction. This, again, we're straddling people locally with mandates, hoping that we can collect data that we can somehow be smarter and wiser about. I think the reality is we need to find ways to encourage our parents to actually parent their kids instead of having saying to them that we're going to create more government to do your job for you. And that parent that you talked about, stay home and parent your kids instead of asking me what type of programs we can develop for them, because I'm afraid that we can't replace that no matter how hard we try and how much money we spend.
Testify?
Okay.
Okay, then we're going to move on. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilton, what bothers me about this bill is this is synonymous with Bobby Joe Campion's racial data, racial profiling data collection bill. It's just about the same type. It looks like we're collecting more information about racial profiling than you are anything else. And I'll let the other agencies defend themselves, but I would appreciate if you'd strike law enforcement agencies from there, because right now it's so paperwork intimidating to pick up a juvenile the way it is. All the forms that you have to fill out about a juvenile, and you have to talk to their parents before you question them. We've got a school resource officer in a little town of 2,500 people. This would be an onerous regulation just for us. I can't imagine what it would be for a big department. We had 62 calls on juveniles in 1 year at our school of 2,500 people. Now, if we have to fill out an additional form for each one of those and keep track of it up through the system, then it goes to the county attorney, the law enforcement center, all those agencies doing this. And it just seems like this is more of a, if this about as onerous as this Bobby Joe Campion's bill with the having to walk up to a car of every single stop you make and hand somebody a card to ask them if they've been a victim of racial profiling, the extent and the time that it would take for this, even for my small department. So just speaking for my own parochial interest, I would like it if law enforcement agency was struck off of that thing, and I'll let the others further up argue their own case. But right now, I think it would be intimidating to make a juvenile arrest when the officer looks at all the things he or she is going to have to do for what the worth of it is anyway. You just put a juvenile in the system, they kick them back out, and they turn into a career criminal. It's just one more thing to discourage peace officers from doing anything about it.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, I had some of your concerns as well. It just been looking at making certain that we are not overburdening the system that is already feeling strapped and knowing the cuts that we're going to be making. The challenge is a lot of this is already collected. The problem is it's not reported in any consistent way. And so if we want to be in compliance with federal law and not have the chance of getting the 20% penalty, we need to make sure that if they're doing the work of collecting the data anyways, that the data they're collecting is useful. And so I'll continue to talk with you and work with others. The goal here is not to have an unfunded mandate or to have something that isn't workable, but to take something that is already being done just in a not workable way and make it productive. So I promise to continue to work with you on
that. There's quite a few stops that you have to make along the way.
That is correct.
Follow-up, Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Representative Hilton. Madam Chair, it's just the problem of when a law enforcement officer picks somebody up, they're going to be second-guessed at the next stage by the prosecutor, and the second-guessed again by the judge that makes the final determination. And so there's already enough checks and balances on us and enough intimidating paperwork. So that was my concern, and all the different, there's forms that we fill out already for data collection. This is going to add some specific entries to it in another form. So that's my concern, but thank you for being aware of that.
Okay. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm still concerned on a few things from the prosecutor point of view. For instance, you run a diversion program in a county which state law says you're supposed to run, and all of a sudden you've got to account for all your diversion people also? And where exactly can I find, or can somebody please give me the exact federal law copy here, because I was like the prosecutor 32 years, never heard of this.
Hilton, just to piggyback off of Representative Olin's question, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Olin, but you have to collect a lot of information anyway that is already required on this, and the forms that are being processed. Maybe it would be helpful to talk a little bit more about the fact that the forms that Representative Olin has to fill out regarding juvenile prosecution, that this is the exact same information, it's just trying to get it in one central location. Either of the testifiers?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can try to answer this question. The federal statute is, I don't have the number, but it's the Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act. It's been around since the early 1970s. And I can get you that legislation if you would like to give you the specific key contact points that the federal legislation mandates us collect the data on. Right now we are currently collecting majority of the data. We are not collecting all of it of those key contact points listed in the federal mandate, and so that's what this legislation is attempting to do.
Yeah.
We are currently, the way it works is the data is being collected by different state agencies, different local jurisdictions, and what we are trying to do is get it all into one place so that we can look at it and analyze it to make our system better for use in our system.
Just a quick comment on that. You said the 1970s. I went back to the beginning of my years as county attorney. Did I ever see a form from the state or anybody asking me for most of that stuff on this piece of paper? No, I have not.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I would ask, was it 1988 that you said we were required to collect the data? So we're about 21 years. Has the state ever been cited or disciplined for not participating?
Thank you, members of the committee. As far as I know, we have been participating up to our ability to collect the data that we have. We don't have all of the data, and that is why we are bringing this forth. But what I know of, we are participating up to our ability currently. And depending upon the Office of Juvenile Justice Programs, the Department of Justice that collects this information, it is up to them to determine whether or not we're in compliance.
Okay, Representative Drozdowski.
Have we ever been cited for the deficiencies for which this legislation is trying to fulfill?
Either of the testifiers.
Madam Chair, Representative, not that I know of. What I have been told is that we're barely in compliance currently.
Sounds like we're doing good.
Okay. Any other questions from members right now? Representative Hilstrom testifies. If you want some final things, we have about 4 minutes, and we still have to ask if there's anybody that would like to testify in favor or opposition of the bill. Okay. We have
I was just going to draw your attention to some of the supporters, including the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers, Minnesota Association of Restitution and Community Services, Minnesota Corrections Association, and the list goes on and on of other Minnesota agencies that would be asked to comply with this legislation who are actually in favor of it.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify in favor or opposition to the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Hilstrom, would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 702 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members. And now I just would like to make two announcements before we adjourn. From now on, the committee will be starting at 12:30. This is in an attempt to cut down on the number of evenings. I've also booked every Thursday evening so that if we don't, we're going to pack our Thursday hearings full. So if we don't finish during Thursday hearing time, we'll be going into the evening on Thursdays. And also, just to let you know that our last prison tour is this Friday, and we're going to Red Wing. Chair, I have one more thing for housekeeping, too, that we need in March 5th meeting minutes. Are you making that motion?
Madam Chair, before you go to that, we really didn't have time to divide that motion. Could we ask for division on that motion? You didn't offer us time to even interject a division on it.
Madam Chair, I think at this point the appropriate motion would be a motion to reconsider because we already have moved to a second item of business, but you certainly would be in order to reconsider the motion if you wanted, Representative Drozdowski.
I didn't vote on the prevailing side.
That is not the rule. You don't have to have been committing. So if you'd like to move to reconsider the motion, you are certainly welcome to do that.
Madam Chair, I'll move to reconsider the vote that was taken on whatever the House file was. It was just
702. Yes. Okay. There is a motion to reconsider. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Okay. Division's been called. Wanting to reconsider, please raise your hand.
Good ears, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, so I will proceed to ask for a
motion on the minutes.
On the minutes, thank you, for March 5th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. And now the committee is adjourned.
Thank you.